Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Okay. I guess I'll just have one more.
One more ambulance.
One more clamp.
One more minute.
One more. All positive.
One more round.
One more gone. Let's call it.
Please, know when to say no more.
So you're hearing from a commercial called Not One More, and this is actually a campaign that's put on by Hartford Healthcare. Joining me this morning is Dr. Shauna Katyal, and she's a trauma acute care surgeon at St. Vincent's Medical Center here this morning to talk about Not One More. Good morning, Dr. Katyal. We appreciate you being here. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to have you here, especially ahead of Memorial Day weekend and going into the summer season. In fact, it's interesting, later on today when we do our summer safety series, we're going to be talking about this with Gary McNamara, drinking and drugging at parties and social events. So I wanted to talk to you, first of all, about what are we seeing here in Connecticut, you know, that sparked the Not One More campaign?
I think we're seeing trends that are happening throughout the country, not just in Connecticut, but we know that 30% of all traffic crash fatalities involve alcohol, and 16% of all motor vehicle crashes involve drugs other than alcohol. So the problem is very real, and I'll say, you know, anecdotally as a trauma surgeon, what I see is that most of the patients who are seriously injured after motor vehicle collisions, there's some component of drugs or alcohol that are related.
How long have you been a trauma surgeon?
I've been a trauma surgeon at St. Vincent's for almost 4 years. And before that, I did my training in D.C. at a level one trauma center, so saw a lot of trauma there as well. That was a little bit less in the motor vehicle collision volume being downtown in D.C., but the patterns were the same.
What I'm getting at is it seems that you've seen enough trauma to be able to make this, I would say, educated statement. How frustrating is it to continue seeing something that is preventable, not drinking and driving?
It's frustrating. It's sad, you know, because we're the people that many times are getting victims of accidents who are coming in, you know, in some cases either severely injured and sort of seeing them pass away in front of our eyes, or people who have actually passed away sort of during an accident that get transported to us. And we see, you know, the heroic measures that everyone takes to try to save these lives. And really prevention is the only thing that would help.
You know, it's interesting, Dr. Katyal, and please interject if I'm wrong, but during COVID, we put so much attention onto our medical professionals because of what you had to endure and see and deal with COVID patients and the influx of people overtaking hospitals and the uncertainty of what COVID was going to bring. And what I find interesting, having a mom who's a registered nurse, is that before COVID ever existed, people don't think on the daily basis what somebody like a trauma surgeon sees and what you have had to endure watching people unnecessarily get hurt or even lose their lives because they decided to drink and drive. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, I think there is there's a lot of emphasis now in healthcare on caring for the caregiver, because I think for a long time, especially as surgeons, we bottle up our emotions and we don't really pay. You know, we sort of treat ourselves as superhuman, but it's extremely emotionally taxing to be the person that has to sit down with someone and tell them that their son or daughter or husband or wife, or even, you know, mother or father, has died in a terrible, horrific manner, and to give them that information, and also to know that there were things that could have prevented that, and that, you know, that person either in some cases directly contributed with their own behavior, or that, you know, someone else was extremely irresponsible and caused an accident that, you know, in many cases, the person who's actually drinking can walk away from, and it's everyone else that's involved in the accident that's the horrible victims.
And I imagine, too, Dr. Katyal, that there's also, I would think, tremendous guilt that a surgeon or a nurse feels watching a life that you so desperately want to save not make it.
That's absolutely the case. I think, in fact, when I was in the middle of my training, I thought if there was anything that I couldn't do, it was being a trauma surgeon, because the toll of looking at people who were not able to be saved was so great. And I really took it very personally when, you know, people would literally come in dead. And if you can't sort of revitalize them, you think, well, if only I was smarter, if only I had acted more quickly, if only I had, you know, studied harder, maybe that's something that I could have done, could have changed that outcome. You know, it's a little bit interesting that I'm even in this field, because that was my take before, and I think that's changed a little bit over time. But it's very difficult to do this work day in and day out, and maintain that belief that we really are doing good for people and that we're making a difference. I think the best way to make a difference is prevention.
We're chatting this morning with Dr. Shauna Katyal, who's a trauma and acute care surgeon for Hartford HealthCare, and we're talking about the Not One More campaign. If you want to learn more about it, you can go to notonemore.org. But before we go to that, tell us, Shauna, about why this campaign really focuses on the trauma teams. Because usually when you hear about don't drink and drive, don't drug and drive, we focus so much on the victim and their stories, which, of course, is important. But I kind of love the fact that we have focused now on, like, the first responder outlook and the trauma teams who have to actually respond and have to, as you mentioned, go up to the families and explain that you've lost a loved one because either they were drinking or someone else was drinking and irresponsibly got behind the wheel and hit their car. So tell us about that shift from focusing now on trauma teams.
You know, I think most of the campaigns that have been aimed at drunk or otherwise impaired driving in the past have really focused on the victims. And I have to think that this sort of came out of seeing what happened during COVID, as you mentioned before, where really the pleas that seemed to really motivate people were the impassioned pleas from the healthcare providers saying, you know, this is what we're seeing. It's heartbreaking, and we know that it's preventable. And please do what you can, you know, to help take care of yourselves and to take care of each other. And so I think that's the reason that the healthcare, the trauma teams in particular, were chosen to be the face of this campaign.
So when you go to notonemore.org, what will you find on that site?
So the main objective of the site the website is to take a pledge to saying no to not one more, one more drink, one more joint, one more whatever. There's also information about, you know, some facts about impaired driving, and then also some resources. So a support if you think that you might have an issue either in the moment. So there's resources for ride options to arrive home safely, and also resources for substance abuse and behavioral health networks in Connecticut. If you think you might have a problem with drinking or other drugs and want to get help.
And there are some really disturbing facts here, if you don't mind me rattling some of them off. Like, for example, on average, a drunk driver will drive 80 times under the influence before they are arrested for the first time. That's 80 chances that they could have killed themselves or other people, which is disturbing. 15 to 20-year-olds are at the greatest risk of driving under the influence. So if that doesn't wake up any parent of a high schooler or a college student, I don't know what will. And even this one is really disturbing. Mm-hmm. Female impaired driving has more than doubled in the last three decades. And you know, and that also questions, you know, the support that women get. You know, if they're working women, they're also mothers, for example, or maybe they've just they're carrying too much or they're single parents. But do we support women enough that they're maybe they're drinking too much when they go to their friends' houses or they're drinking, you know, after work to kind of like take off the edge and then they're driving? You know, who knows? But there are some really disturbing facts on there and some trends that I would think anyone would be upset about.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think there's no question that in the, I like to call it the post-pandemic, we're not really post-pandemic, we're sort of peri-pandemic still. But, you know, everyone has gotten a lot more stress in the last 2 years. Our lives have just become much more difficult and challenging, and a lot of people are turning to alcohol or other drugs. So I think that it's especially important in this period of time to really focus on this. And offer the support and resources, especially for women. So we're doing a little bit of everything.
So what would be your final message this morning, Dr. Katyal, for anyone who is going into a celebratory weekend for Memorial Day weekend or knows that this summer they're going to let loose, they've got some weekends planned, or they've got some plans that they're going to be doing after work for cocktail hours, things like that. What would be your message to them?
My message is go out, have fun, just do so in a responsible and planned manner. So if you're planning to go to a party, you know, plan to either take a rideshare service or a taxi or carpool with somebody. Before you're going out drinking, make sure that there's somebody that's going to be the designated non-drinker in the group that's going to make sure everyone else gets home safely. Because we don't want your family to be the family that we have to tell that something terrible has happened to.
And if you could speak to one more thing, Dr. Katyal, then I'll let you go. I know kids, you know, when you look at that factoid, 15 to 20-year-olds are the greatest risk of driving under the influence. A lot of times it's because, well, it's illegal, right? I mean, it's illegal, so they're going to go and get it from friends who are older, or they're going to get it at parties or whatever it is. How important is it that parents strike a balance? I know a lot of parents will say, I don't want to talk to my kids and tell them, hey, call me if you get drunk, because you're condoning their actions. Wouldn't you agree, though, that there's a middle ground there to say, listen, I don't want you to die, okay? So if you make a stupid decision, please call me. I'm not telling you to go out and drink, but I'm telling you to call me because I'd rather you be a dope and get home safely and scream at you and ground you than to die. You know what I mean? Like, those conversations have to happen.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, I think the fact of the matter is none of us are perfect. Every single one of us are human. Every single one of us is going to, you know, at the end of our lives, have things that we wish that we hadn't done, or things that we look back on and say, man, I was really lucky that something didn't go really wrong there. Mm-hmm. And so I think if we can extend that sort of grace and reflect back on our own histories and know that, you know, we've all made mistakes, and extend that grace to other people and sort of allow people to make mistakes, but also provide for their safety. I think that's the better approach rather than just pretending like it doesn't happen. Cause as you mentioned, 15 to 20 year olds are the most likely, group to get into impaired driving situations. Mm-hmm. And so it certainly happens. I think let's support the kids so that they know that they have a safe place to fall back on.
Mm-hmm. And just don't put the fear of God in them that they'd rather risk their own lives than call their own parents. I think that's That's one of the, that's a really hard thing. Like, I understand being fearful. I understand wanting perfect children. I too would love that. I'd love for my son to never have that happen. But I think realistically, I would rather him go, Mom, I'm dumb. I did this, or I fell into peer pressure. You know what, Mom? I like to drink. That's what's going on. I'd rather him call me with that than to bury my child any day. So just don't put the fear of God in your kids. Make sure they're comfortable enough. Like, they fear you. You know, that's okay. Put a little fear in them. Like, don't let them feel like, oh, yeah, Mom and Dad are going to let it happen. But don't put the fear of God in them, that they don't feel comfortable calling you in that situation. And Dr. Katayal, I want to thank you and all of the people who represent our trauma teams. Thank you for all that you do. I'm sorry that you have to do the work that you do, but I thank you for doing it and for being part of this campaign, Not One More. And again, notonemore.org if you want to learn more information. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Katayal here on WICC.
Staying smart while having some fun in the sun. It's Melissa in the Morning Summer Safety Week, now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
And today's aspect is drinking and drugging at parties. Joining us this morning is a good friend of mine, someone you are familiar with on the show. That's Gary McNamara. Gary is with Sacred Heart University. As I mentioned, you've heard from Gary many times. He's with the Public Safety Command staff. He's the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs. He's also the former Chief of Police in Fairfield. Good morning, Gary. Thanks for being here. Gary, let's get right into today's topic. I apologize for the delay. So we're talking about drugging and drinking at parties. I was saying this could happen at underage parties. This could happen on the beaches in Fairfield and some of our other towns. This could be at even corporate events. This could be people going to parties with their jobs. Tell us about some of the things we start to see a little bit more during the summertime when it comes to drugging and drinking at parties.
So I think it's a really important conversation, in fact, all week is, because we have to pause for a minute and recognize the reason we're discussing this, you're discussing it all week, is because of experiences that we have. We're trying to avoid tragedy that occurs when these events happen. So first of all, that's why it's very important. The other thing to keep in mind is the fire department does a really good job with this at a critical incident. And the police, for that matter, try to. They have a safety officer, and the whole point of a safety officer is to have somebody there that their full responsibility is to make sure that the scene is safe for the responders as best as they can. We don't necessarily do that when we have gatherings and we have alcohol, because gatherings and alcohol go hand in hand. And the problem is we set up the umbrellas, we set up the grill, we put ice in the buckets, but we never, at the moment of planning and starting to have the guests come, we never take a moment to say that alcohol and parties can have some tragic effects hours down the line. And that's kind of the conversation we have to have. You have to kind of focus on the fact of not now, not at the beginning of the party. It's at the end of the party that safety really matters. And at that end of the party, alcohol, people are intoxicated, and their decision-making process isn't always the best.
Mm-hmm. We're chatting with Gary McNamara this morning. Gary is the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs, but also the former Chief of Police in Fairfield. We're talking about drinking and drugging at parties. So, Gary, my question is for parents who allow drinking at their homes. Sometimes they don't openly say, hey, everyone, come to my house and drink. It's fine. I don't think a lot of parents do that. But there are some parents who are like, hey, if it's in my home, it's safe. I can monitor them. It's five kids. I've got this. What do you say to those parents?
Well, I mean, it's criminal. In 2012, the state of Connecticut passed a social host law, and it basically puts the onus on the parents or somebody who owns the property. And basically what it says is that if you host a party where there's alcohol, you're responsible for that. It's a misdemeanor. And it basically it says that either the parents knew, I mean, let's put it in the fact of the parents, either the parents knew or your scenario where they actually allow it or they should have known. And that's part of a key component of it. So parents, it takes away the thing that parents are like, well, I didn't know I was upstairs. I didn't know what they were doing. So it's if they knew or if they should have known, number one. The other thing is, obviously, if you're serving alcohol to minors, that bumps it up or potentially could bump it up into a felony. So there are some laws behind it. But beyond that, Melissa, when we're talking about underage drinking, We're talking about binge drinking, alcohol poisoning, fights, injuries. Everything stems from that. So driving after the party, kids, you know, kids becoming sick, pass out. We've had incidents occur where kids have died at house parties because, number one, you're drinking, and then the kids are afraid to tell somebody, so they don't want to call because they're fearful they're going to get in trouble for it. So they don't call and really get the medical help that someone needs.
But there are laws to protect those people, right? Didn't you and I talk about that once before, that there are laws in place to protect people if you're having illegal substances, that if you report and you actually save someone's life because you literally recalled in and said, hey, this person passed out, or hey, this person's excessively throwing up, I'm worried about them. Isn't there some degree of protection over the person who reports it, even if you were also engaging in those activities?
There is, and that's the point, is that, you know, we don't want these parties to happen in the first place, so there's laws in place to prevent it. Parents, hey, listen, if you want to take on that responsibility, have at it, but that's not a responsibility you should take because you could be criminally liable. And then in addition to that, if the party does occur, there is an off-ramp, and that's what we have to get the message out to, that we don't want the parties to happen, but if they happen and kids are drinking and your friend is passed out next to you, you have to call for help. And there is some ability for you to say, listen, I get it. We were violating laws, but at the same time, I need to get my friend help. So there is some ways in which you can be covered if you call for help. We want to take away any barrier it is to get help for the individual, because, as I said in the past, house parties where kids in the basement, people are fearful to call for an ambulance and they end up dying in the house.
Right. We're talking to Gary McNamara this morning about drinking and drugging at parties this summer and how to prevent getting yourself into a lot of trouble, but also hurting yourself or other people. Let's also talk about public drinking. I mean, you were the chief of police for a long time in Fairfield, Gary, so you're no stranger to the parties on the beaches, especially by university college students. What are the rules about drinking in public in open containers?
Well, each municipality would have different laws, but generally I know in the town of Fairfield, it's illegal to have an open container in public. At the same time, does it happen? Sure, it happens. And we always, you know, weigh enforcement with responsibility, you know, and down at the beach, there's no alcohol allowed at the beach. But, you know, some people would argue, well, if you're down there with your significant other and you're having a glass of wine while watching the sunset, is that something that we want to engage in? So the laws are there, but at the same time, we want people, regardless, to be responsible in the way in which they are consuming alcohol.
Do you worry at all, Gary, about people drinking and boating?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Drinking and boating and drinking and swimming. The issue with the drinking and operating a boat is that it's a little bit more difficult to enforce. So driving or drinking and driving, obviously, you can have random patrols. You can have roadblocks. The ability to discover someone who is drinking on a boat while operating a boat is a little bit more difficult. There are marine divisions that do that, and they, you know, they do take some steps to do some random stops, but it's much more difficult. And people have a relaxed atmosphere that I'm on a boat. I'm not drinking and driving. I'm just on a boat. And, you know, like either a lake or in Long Island Sound, you know, operating any device requires a straightforward thinking process. And when you're combining alcohol with that, your decision making is poor. You know, having water skiers on the back of the boat, having a lot of people in the boat. We've seen tragedies happen because people have been drinking while driving the boat. So, yeah, that's a big concern. Swimming, you know, everything stems from, well, not everything, but when you drink alcohol, your decision-making process is less. So you always have to remember that we forget to practice safety when we're consuming the more alcohol we consume. And unfortunately, we've seen tragedies happen in the past.
And this is my last question, Gary. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I had a question for the parents, or the families, I should say, who have crashed parties. So ever since texting became something, forget social media, that's a whole other realm. But as soon as texting became a reality, high school students especially love to crash parties. They just love it. They did it in my day. They continue to do it. They did it, you know, they've done it for a very long time. And, you know, I know we talk about if the parents are aware or not aware. What do you suggest a parent do? So say they've got one of their high school kids. They invite 10 friends over. Fine. They're having a bonfire in the backyard. Seems pretty normal. All of a sudden, you've got 100 kids in your yard, and you're like, what do I even do with this? What do you suggest they do to avoid as much trouble and to avoid any kind of issues on their property as possible? What do you suggest?
They call the police to break it up. I mean, we've had that down the beach in Fairfield with some of the university students down at the beach, where they've had a little gathering and it turns into a large gathering. And we always encourage them, before we get complaints from the neighbors, call so that we can go down there and break up the party. Don't be hesitate in that thing, because you saw in the Shelton incident.
Right.
Now, whether or not they crashed the party or not, you see what can happen when a party gets out of control.
Well, that's just it. So, they did crash the party. And, right.
Well, that's exactly it. So if you get the sense and you're a parent or you come home to that, you got to call and ask the police to help break it up. Once you put the cruise lights on and you show up in the neighborhood, generally kids will disperse. I mean, the challenges there are kids getting in the car when they're drinking? You know, those are other challenges that have to be addressed. But if you have a party at your house, or you're a parent and there's a party at your house and it's getting out of control, you have to call to get some assistance to break it up. It can unravel very quickly from there.
Yeah. As my parents always said, just call the cops on yourself. It's okay. That's my parents would often do. My brother, who went to Fairfield Prep, I swear they had a few instances where he would come home with 5 friends after a football game. Then all of a sudden there were 100 kids in our yards. And my parents were notorious for calling the cops on themselves. Even before the party would happen, they would say, my son's coming home from a game. I have a feeling it's going to get crashed. And there would actually be a police officer who would be in that vicinity, not on our street, but in the vicinity, almost like waiting for it to happen. So yeah, always call the cops on yourselves. That's the first thing.
Melissa, at the end of the day, we want people to be alive at the end of the weekend.
Exactly.
And that really is the harsh reality of it. And they have to remember that tragedies happen, and we want to try to avoid them.
Mm-hmm. And really quick, Gary, do you think with police shortages right now, they would still respond as soon as possible to something like that, an inquiry like that, especially in the summer where we're going to see an uptick in parties?
Yeah, I mean, limited resources have always been there. So, yeah, Friday night, it's busy anyway. So even when you have a full staff contingent, there's resource limitations. So you get to it when you can. And it might not be the first priority, but it's certainly something that they're going to get to. They're eventually going to respond to it. So don't not call because you think the cops aren't going to come. I mean, you call, and when they get the resources available, they're certainly going to do that.
Yeah. Well, you and I both know, unfortunately, we live in a society where, for good reason, a lot of people feel like they're going to call, and unfortunately, cops are either not able to respond to crimes like they used to, or they just don't have the resources to do so. So, that's going to be a question from people.
Yeah,
why bother?
It's challenging. Public safety and interactions and all that kind of stuff has always been challenging and always will be challenging. But don't hesitate to reach out, and maybe we can come up with some solutions to help facilitate that.
Gary McNamara, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on. Sorry for the phone trouble earlier. I appreciate you.
No worries. Be well.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Melissa in the Morning spends a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
When are we going to do something? I'm tired. I'm so tired of getting up here and offering condolences to the devastated families that are out there. I'm so tired of I'm tired of the moments of silence. Enough.
So you're hearing from a very emotional Golden State Warriors coach, Steve Kerr, who this was a press conference that went viral yesterday because he said, we're not talking about basketball today. We're not going to pretend like another horrific tragedy didn't happen 400 miles away from us in Texas. Good morning, Senator Richard Blumenthal. I know this is very much on the top of your mind, as well as many senators across our country. And thank you so much for taking the time to come on this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. It is very much on my mind, as I would strongly guess it is on the minds of so many Connecticut people who watched a similar tragedy unfold at Sandy Hook. Their 20 beautiful children perished in a really eerily similar way at the hands of a murderer And like the parents at Sandy Hook, the moms and dads, in this instance, their family, their loved one, returned home that night to a house with a room and a tiny bed that will never be filled again by their beautiful child. And as a parent, I know there are a lot of parents listening. It seems incomprehensible that anyone would be so cruel and brutal and possibly deranged, but we need to, once again, try to match our thoughts and prayers with action. And I have spoken to the Sandy Hook families in the last 24, 48 hours, and they are determined as ever to help pursue gun violence prevention reforms. And their strength and courage continue to inspire me. So I just feel very strongly that we have an obligation to seek at the federal level the kinds of reforms that the state of Connecticut adopted after Sandy Hook. We have a red flag statute in Connecticut that separates people from guns when they are dangerous to themselves or others. We have universal background checks, as well as now Ethan's Law, named after Ethan Song, who perished in Guilford, Connecticut, the son of Kristen and Michael Song, because of an unsecured weapon. There are a range of reforms that we can take, and they save lives, and I hope that we will take.
It sounds like, Senator Blumenthal, you and Chris Murphy yesterday spoke with Senate Republicans. You had a lot of conversations yesterday about several measures, including the one you just mentioned, the red flag law. How do you feel like those conversations went?
I think they went well for initial conversations. They were hopeful. I met with the senator who has been my Republican partner in the red flag statute effort I've been working on for 3 years, seeking to get more bipartisan support. Remember, a red flag statute would, in effect, enable a law enforcement officer, if asked by a family, to go to a court, get an order based on evidence that this person is dangerous to himself or others, if he threatens to kill other people or kill himself. Remember also that more than half of all gun deaths are suicides, and many of them can be prevented. And then if the gun were separated from that person, there's a right to due process both before and after. And then a hearing, an opportunity to be heard, evidence-based, and a finding again by a judicial officer. So there are lots of protections to Second Amendment rights, but still a process to essentially separate someone when they are about to do something that can never be taken back, either to someone else or to themselves. So I'm hopeful. I have to be hopeful when I go to work in the morning. Otherwise, I couldn't do it.
Right.
But I can't predict what will happen.
I mean, I'm hearing rumblings that we could potentially finally see more gun laws in place, or at least being voted on, as early as June. I mean, I know that you're hopeful, obviously, of it, but like, tell us, I mean, you don't have to get into detail, but tell us, like, what are some of the reactions from Senate Republicans, you know, and why are you feeling hopeful when it's been almost 10 years since Sandy Hook and essentially nothing's come out of the Senate?
I'm asked often, are you optimistic? Are you confident? And I am neither. But I am hopeful because we are talking again. And we had a meeting yesterday, for example, involving the bipartisan group. Senator Murphy and I are in conversations with people, and it could happen. There could be a vote as early as the beginning of June.
So we're talking to Senator Blumenthal this morning. Guns are one thing, and I have always said, I've been very honest with my listeners, I agree with universal background checks. I agree that if you have evidence and you go through the court process correctly, that if you feel someone's in danger, they should have guns taken from them temporarily until they have been deemed safe to have them. I agree with even eliminating things like semi-automatic weapons because I can't imagine why the heck anyone would need them, quite frankly. With that being said, what about conversations about mental health? Because again, going back to the shooter, I know we focus a lot on the victims, which we should. I'm not saying we shouldn't. But let's talk about the shooter. How is it that we continue to have kids get to the point that they're 16, 17, 18 years old and they want to go through with killing children who have nothing to do with their past, have nothing to do with their bullying situations or whatever isolation they've been in? What are we doing to address securing and helping children not get to the point of wanting to become mass murderers?
Your point is absolutely right. We need to do more about mental health. We are doing somewhat more, but nowhere near enough. The bills that have been passed over the last few years and months provide more funding for counseling and mental health care, but there's still a need to do more to provide the resources that will reach out to kids, perhaps like the 18-year-old who committed this brutal atrocity in Uvalde. But mental health has to be coupled with other measures. For example, in order to receive a gun back in a red flag statute proceeding, often the individual is required to go through some kind of counseling or therapy to determine whether they're dangerous. That's an initial determination that has to be done, but also whether they can overcome whatever is troubling them. And we need to talk about school security as well. Connecticut has made its schools much more secure without turning them into fortresses. As you know, identification is required when people go into schools. Now in most schools,
I agree.
Locks and so forth.
I will say, Senator Blumenthal, really quick, I know we've run out of time, but I think it's worth putting campaigns out there, though, and maybe revitalizing. I don't know if Texas is probably enough for schools to be on edge, but I actually walked into a Bridgeport school the other day and was buzzed in without being asked who I am. And I entered that school and I faced about 25 students right there at a clip. And I thought to myself, thank God I'm not someone who's deranged and carrying a gun in here. I do think we've become a little lax, even here in Connecticut. I can't speak for all schools, but you're right. We have the technology in place. We have the measures in place. But I do think as a nation, we're also getting lax. Like, how did this kid even get into that school in Texas?
Well, that's why I'm raising the topic, Melissa. I think school security is important, not enough alone. Mental health is important. We need to do more in terms of gun violence prevention, as Connecticut has done, and our experience in Connecticut shows that it can have an effect in diminishing gun deaths. But we're at the mercy of states with the weakest laws, even though we're one of the strongest. And the reason is guns really have no respect for state boundaries. They travel from other states where there are no background checks. And that's one of the reasons why we need federal legislation.
Senator Blumenthal, I appreciate you coming on this morning, and I'm sure we'll continue talking about this for weeks to come. Thank you so much.
Have a great Memorial Day to you and your listeners.
Thank you. You too.